And Jesus himself said that he did not come to do away with the law.
This is the Adventist Pilgrimage Podcast with your hosts, Michael Campbell and Greg Howell.
We have a really special guest for us here today. Dr. John Butler is going to be jumping in and sharing some of his own vantage point on American historiography, specifically Adventist historiography. And we just want to say thank you, Dr. Butler, for coming in here and joining us on the podcast.
I'm very happy to do it.
Yeah, well, we're just delighted to have you and wanted to begin kind of at the beginning and, you know, tell us a little bit about your journey, how you got started, how you got interested in Adventist history and American religious history.
Well, it probably goes back to the seminary. I was a theology major in college, but not a history major. But I got back to the seminary. I took a seminar on American religion from Roy Branson. He was a new faculty member there from Harvard, and he taught ethics. And I was very interested in ethics because he was such a charismatic guy. But I took this class in American religion, and we read a bunch of American religion books, you know, Sidney Mead and Perry Miller and Whitney Cross and Timothy Smith and all these. You know, we had to read a book a week and write about it. And that had a huge impact on me. And I got to know Martin Marty by doing that. And he was at Chicago and he'd been a student of Sidney Mead's. But anyway, that was, I don't think I would have taken medieval history for a career, or I wouldn't have taken European history. I was interested in American religion because it provided this context for Seventh-day Adventism. So it was sort of a way of exploring my own tradition from the outside, I guess you'd say.
Nice. Well, then what kind of, looking at your own Adventist tradition then, what was your background that you kind of came into this with? You said you went to seminary, but what kind of background did you have in this that would even, you know, spurred you in this study in the first place?
Well, I grew up in Southern California, and my father was a non-Adventist and my mother was an Adventist. But all the kids went to Adventist schools, and my dad was happy about that. He thought that was a good thing for us. But I worked up through, Glendale Academy. I got there as a middle school student, and then went to La Sierra, and that was in the era when Fritz Guy was there, and Royal Sage and Walter Specht and people like that, and I was a theology major at La Sierra. A little bit conflicted about it. I wasn't sure I wanted to be a man of the cloth, you know, but I did feel a sort of a call, I guess you'd say, to do that. And then I went to the seminary, but I think I became more attracted to the seminary professors than I had been to many ministers. You know, I liked the life they lived. And so, and they challenged me and interested me. And so it was there I said, well, you know, I was on call to the Southern California Conference. But I said, you know, maybe I'll go get a PhD now. You don't have any kids and we're got the time. And then I hadn't intended to go back to a pastorate. But I'm not sure they wanted me after I'd been to Chicago, and Union did want me. So that's the way it went.
You lost your collar, but you gained the ivory tower, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Tell us about your early teaching experience a little bit. You know, here you are transitioning from grad school, and now you're teaching Adventist young people about, what were you teaching? And tell us a little bit about that journey.
Well, at Union, I was teaching in the religion department, which was a very interesting department in those days, in my view. Ward Hill was kind of the one I was closest to. these are people that are before your time, I think. But John Baldwin was there as kind of a new faculty. I mean, he went on to theology at the seminary. And there were several. Floyd Brzee was the chair, and he ended up in the ministry department. So it was a great place to be. And I had been trained in church history, but they put me in the religion department. And I was teaching some Bible, but then also church history. And I was telling Greg that Doug Morgan was my he showed up in my classes as a freshman, and I was teaching upper division classes, but he wanted to take my classes, so he took all my classes in his first 2 years there, and he was really an interesting person to get to know. And then he went on to Chicago and was a student of Marty's and did his book on Adventism in the American Republic. So he was kind of, it was kind of nice to be tag teaming with him, you know, through Chicago. I taught 2 years at Union, and then I wouldn't say I wanted to leave at all, but it was sort of pulled toward La Sierra. My family was out in California, and we were sort of between our two families, and they sort of twisted my arm, and I went. There were many things I missed about living in Lincoln, Nebraska. I really enjoyed that and enjoyed the college. You know, you're sort of a big fish in a small pond at Union in a way. But also Lincoln is such a great city to live in. You know, it's a capital city, and the college is integrated into the community. It isn't some outlier, some marginal place. It's, you know, Seventh-day Adventists are part of the mix out there, and I like that. But then I went out to La Sierra, and I was there for basically 10 years at La Sierra.
So I want to, before we move on to some other things, you know, you're at Chicago, Martin Marty. Yeah, I've always heard from several people. I think most recently Lisa Diller at Southern, who also went to Chicago. You know, had a very friendly interactions with Adventists. So what was that like, and what did you work on for your dissertation?
Yeah, Marty is a great person. I mean, he pays attention to students. He is a very busy person, and he basically wrote a book every year and edited a book every year. He would take a trip to Europe with his family and come back, and he was unpacked and everything was put away in 10 minutes. This is the kind of guy he was. If you went in to ask for a letter of recommendation, he said, keep talking, and he would turn to his typewriter. In those days, it was a typewriter. He would dash out the letter, turn back toward you, and hand it to you in the few minutes, you know, in the middle of the interview. I mean, he did everything now, and he got a great deal done. But he also, I probably needed faculty that I could just hang out with, and I found that in Gerald Brower, who had been dean when I got there, but then retired as dean and went back in the classroom. And I hung out with him more. Marty was, you would do the 10-minute blocks for appointments. So you'd say, I have a 10-minute appointment with Marty. But I would accumulate things, and so it was 20 minutes. I said, okay, I really need to talk to him for 20 minutes. And then after 10 minutes, we were done. I mean, he had handled everything, and there was nothing left, you know. But I really needed probably to sort of shoot the bull a little more. So he was, I wouldn't say he was the greatest fit for me in a lot of ways, but he certainly, it wasn't his fault. I mean, he was very attentive, and I learned a lot from him. And in some ways, I've learned a lot from him since, too. I mean, reading his thing, thinking about what he said, you know. When I first met him, he said, well, I don't think you should do anything on the Seventh-day Adventists. I think you should stay away from that. He said, you'll get in trouble if you write about the Seventh-day Adventists. And you want a career that is, you don't want a parochial career. You want to be somebody that is taken seriously beyond Seventh-day Adventism. So I studied millennialism all the way through. I was taking courses in early church, medieval, modern, always thinking about millennialism. But my dissertation was a little bit of a departure from what it was on. It was on heaven and hell in American revivalism, 1870, 1920. So I was dealing with the Dwight Moody's and the Billy Sundays and all that. And I don't think my passion was in that dissertation. I don't think it was by any means the best writing I did. And late in my Chicago years, I was asked to do a paper to be part of a conference out at Loma Linda. And I wrote Adventism in the American Experience, the essay that's The Rise of Adventism. And that I was still at Chicago then, and they read it. I mean, Marty and, they read it and critiqued it, and Brower read it. And in some ways, I think it helped me with them. I mean, they said, oh, yeah, they weren't worried about me doing SDA topics. Maxwell had gone through there, Mervyn Maxwell, and he had sort of alienated himself from a lot of Chicago professors. Not so much for what he did at Chicago. He was a very credible and high performing student. It's what he did after he left there. They felt embarrassed by some of the things he did that were so sort of in-house and parochial and outside his field. He was trained in early church and so
you're talking about Mervyn Maxwell, just for listeners.
Right. And when I was in my doctoral exams, his name came up, and one of the people on the exam who didn't know me very well said, do we have another Mervyn Maxwell on our hands here? I don't know if you need to bleep this out, but anyway, they said no, I mean, the other professors, Marty, and so I came to my rescue and said, no, he's not like that. But it was a good experience for me. It might have been unnecessary to keep me away from the SDA. I mean, I was working in, I was thinking about the SDAs and working in ways on millennialism and so on that were helping me understand SDA history. But anyway, it worked out well.
So that's an interesting, you're kind of bridging the gap there between definitely a more secular historian perspective and then the parochial one, as you said. I'm just kind of curious, how did you figure out how to make those two worlds kind of work together? Because like you said, I know that some impressions can leave a bad taste on one side. And even in my own experience, I've gone to a school that's not primarily Adventist for my own doctoral work. And it's been interesting to kind of be that bridging element between, where you're dealing with other past experiences with Adventists. You're the newest one. How do you overcome? What was the way that you found was the best to kind of give some credibility back to the denomination's scholarship in general?
Yeah, I think from that seminar I took at the seminary from Branson, I was interested in the context of Seventh-day Adventism, the milieu, and how it influenced the church, or how the church resisted it. Both happened. It's kind of a contradiction. SDAs are very like their environment in some way, and they take distinctive paths in other ways. So that obsessed me. I just was very, very interested in it. So I wouldn't have to have been, but that's what lit my fire. And so I come at Seventh-day Adventism from the outside. I don't do that sort of granular interior work. I rely on other people who do that. to tell the story from the inside out. I tell it from the outside in. And certainly Chicago helped there. I mean, there were Seventh-day Adventists there in the Divinity School. Rick Rice was there, but he was in another department. So you feel in a certain way isolated. You know, you're an SDA. They know who SDAs are. They were quite pleased with SDAs there. I mean, somebody said, one of the people in the medieval department said, are all Seventh-day Adventists smart? You know, I mean, because they were used to these people coming through that were high performing people. And we sort of chuckled about it because we knew this wasn't necessarily a representative sample, you know, of the Allegheny Conference or something. But the reputation was good. You didn't have to sort of scratch and claw. And at Chicago, they celebrated your distinctiveness. Langdon Gilkey, the theologian, told Fritz Guy when he arrived, "We don't want to make a non-Adventist out of you. We want you to be an Adventist and go back to Adventism with what you've learned here." So that makes you feel good. It made Fritz feel good because he had no intention of using Chicago as an exit ramp, you know. So they did celebrate. I mean, they're liberals, you know, so they celebrate being tolerant, you know, and having all kinds of. So I would show up at Marty's house for a party, and there was liquor there and sherry in the bowl, and he would come over and very ceremoniously drop a Mountain Dew in front of me with a cup of ice, and you know, and I would
little did he know though the caffeine content. I mean, that's still an issue. Come on,
I know. I didn't want to say anything, you know. I was a little embarrassed by it, almost, to be singled out. Mm-hmm. I would rather just have slinked around pretending I was drinking or something. But but that was his way, his gesture. Saying, look, you know, you don't have to carouse here, you know. So,
John, you mentioned earlier about this conference on leads to the book, The Rise of Adventism. You're writing a chapter. That chapter becomes quite significant and influential in Adventist historiography. Tell us a little bit more about that and some of the other early Adventist historians that you began to rub shoulders with. I'm thinking now of like Gary Land and Run Numbers. How did you bump into these guys?
I wrote this essay. It was a conference that Run Numbers and Vern Carner had sort of co-chaired and co-hosted. And so it was on the rise of Adventism, and they had all non-SDAs coming out for this thing. Winthrop Hudson was one of them. I'd have to go back and look at names now, but so they wanted Timothy Smith, I think it was, they wanted to deal with the context of the church, but then they wanted an essay on Adventism too, specifically on Adventism. And so I was at Chicago then en route to Union. And so they asked me to do it. And I don't think I knew Ron Numbers a whole lot by then. I mean, I got to know him through this. And I was invited out to they had a lecture going on through the whole year. So people would come out every month or so. And so I did mine toward the end. And and this was, and then Ed Gauss, Numbers was a little put off by this because Carner was a student of Ed Gauss, who was a big name in American religion at that time and teaching at UCR. And so on his own, Carner goes to Ed Gauss and said, would you edit this book? Because he wanted to get it published, which it was published through Harper and Row. He said, would you edit this book? And Gossage said, sure, you know, you got all those names in there. Well, I'll do that. And so he came back and told Numbers. And Numbers, who hadn't published anything yet, right? He was at Loma Linda. He had been at Andrews for a year, and now he's at Loma Linda. And he wanted to publish it. You know, he had in mind, you know, that this was going to be his first, it's going to be an edited book that he published. But here Carner had sort of out flanked him. And so he ended up, he went on and was writing while he was at Loma Linda. And that's when he wrote Prophets of Health there, of course. And I knew him pretty well by then. And so he would tell me, he would regale me with all that he was learning about Ellen White while he was doing Prophetess Felt. But we see this edgy side of Numbers in those days. And he was, he of course ended up with this bombshell of a book that had everybody up in arms. But he was also, there was this other side to him. He was really the founding father of Adventist Heritage. He wanted a journal that lay Adventists could enjoy, and not, he didn't want it to be preachy. He wanted it to be history, but kind of like an American Heritage only for Adventism. And Gary Land came on board. So Ron, Gary Land, and I were the first three editors of it. Now when Prophet's Health came out, everybody sort of felt like Numbers couldn't be an editor anymore of it because he was just such a pariah. I would say that if you were here. He was a little, I think, hurt by that because he had, it was his idea. It was his brainchild. And he wanted people sticking up for him more than they did. But it, I think realistically, it was sort of impossible to keep him on there. Now, he also was involved with the Adventism in America. That series, it was supposed to be a series. And that was, again, well, he had to leave that project and because of the Prophet's Health. But Gary Land took that one over. So we were all kind of working together. We were geographically at a distance a bit in that period. But we were doing things together and writing together and so on. Gary I had known when I was a seminary student. He was a brand new professor at the seminary and was a unique figure because he never went to movies, but he read fiction. So he was deeply versed in fiction, but he didn't believe he should go to the movies. As he was interesting, that wouldn't, I doubt that's remain, but I mean, when he got there, exactly. And I became quite close to him in that period and went down to Chicago, would come up and visit him and see him. But these guys were lifelong friends. I mean, Ron was a lifelong friend. I think of Ron and I as sort of different voices, different styles, but he's very encouraging of what I do. He's very supportive of what I do. And I've always been very supportive of him. I mean, I think he kind of put the SDAs on the map historiographically in many ways. Contemporary Seventh-day Adventist people read him. They know him. Marty loved him. Mm-hmm. I mean, Marty was probably closer to Numbers than he was to me. I mean, he did projects with him. And, so the church, I think, owes him for that and can be, you know, he has his little prickly side to him. But he's always been interested in real history, not expose, not exit literature, not that toxic kind of writing. He wants you to write good history. And if you write good history, he is very supportive.
Mm. You know, what I hear you saying is that there's a sense that the church needs, not like you said, just good history. but an ability to reflect on itself from a little bit of the outside in. And I'd be curious, kind of what do you feel that what place is good church history going to fill for the regular rank and file, you know, Adventists that just go and they show up and they read their quarterly? And what can historiography in Adventism do for the regular people, in your sense?
Yeah, I think a lot of the history that's written from the outside in, you sort of write for the non-Adventist, right? You're writing for the field at large. But I think Seventh-day Adventists eavesdrop on that and are interested in it. The stuff that's written from the inside out that will end up in the ABCs, you know, that can also be very inspiring and interesting to people, but it's probably not going to get paid attention to by scholars in general so much. The essay I did in church history a couple of years ago, and by the way, that was a Ron Numbers idea. He went to them and said, you know, there's all these books being written in the Adventist Pioneer series, and you guys aren't reviewing them in church history. And some of them, not all of them necessarily, but many of them, are valuable. You know, they're dealing with the primary sources. They're arguing a thesis. You're learning a lot about the church, and you need to know about these. And so they said, well, who can we get to do it? And he mentioned my name. And the guy who was editing the church history reviews at that time was John Butler, ironically, you know, he had come from Yale and he's retired in Minnesota, but he's still writing. And so, and we knew each other and had corresponded and talked and so on. But anyway, it's kind of fun that he, I call him the real John Butler. First time we talked was he had gotten a royalties check that belonged to me for The Disappointed. They thought it was the real John Butler at Yale, you know, that had done The Disappointed. And so he called me up and he said, I've got a check for you, you know, royalties check. So we got to talking on the phone a little bit then. That was sort of the breakthrough. But it's mostly a compliment to me, you know, if we're confused, way most. Like people have come up to Numbers and thought that John Butler at Yale had written that introduction to Prophetess Felt, the historian as heretic. They thought that was him. And Butler did use it in Yale in his classes, and he said that the students really respond to that introduction. And the same thing happened at Duke. You know, they would assign it, and these kids coming out of religion backgrounds who are a little tormented at times, that introduction interested them as much as the book. So I took that as I took it as a compliment, but it had to do with the, you know, this sort of story of conflict that Ron represented. I mean, you know, people don't recognize how Seventh-day Adventist he was, even when he was writing that book. You know, they look back now at the numbers since, and he's pretty far removed, but he really was very, very much part of the church at that time. But anyway, I've lost my way here. You were asking about the outside in thing. Yeah, I mean, I think the Pioneer series is a good place for a lot of people to start. I mean, you know, for a lot of You look at Gil Valentine's book on Jane Andrews. I mean, you don't come out the same kind of Adventist after you've read that book as you were before, typically. Mm-hmm. I tell him it's too long. You know, he should have. We did need another bookend, you know. But but people read it. I mean, you get into it and they don't stop reading it.
Yeah. I actually had a person over the last weekend who came up and was like, "Hey, I'm reading Andrew's book in that series, and I am really having to like step back and rethink some stuff." And that was, you know, just a church member who's like dipping their toes in this stuff. I find it interesting. You mentioned that the students it was hitting a nerve. Thinking of the historian as heretic introduction that you did there. Why? There's lots of questions that this could bring up, you know, intellectual honesty. What is the role of the historian in a denominational setting? Why do you think that it hit the students as hard as it did? Because like you said, some of them were tortured souls coming out of their own faith groups. But why does that seem to hit, especially the field of history when we're talking about churches, do you think?
Yeah. A lot of this stuff, I think, is very nuanced. I mean, there are people that read Prophetess of Health that didn't know this was a critical book about Ellen White. They thought it was a very apologetic book about her. I mean, not everyone thought that way, but there were reviewers that came to Numbers and thought he had been too nice to her. Mm-hmm. So they don't know what a struggle it may have been for the author of that book to write that book, you know, or what he went through, and they don't realize the blowback, you know, from the book. So I think the introduction helped, you know, the historian as heretic helped on that. I mean, I wrote that in the early 90s for the second edition, you know. So Numbers told me, he said, I had written a thing in Insight years ago on my dad. I called it Dad. It was entered it in a short story contest. He was a non-Adventist. And then about my college years, he became an Adventist. He retired. He was older than my mother, retired and became an Adventist. And it was a very sort of affectionate story about him. Well, Numbers said when he asked me to write the introduction, and we were up in Colorado Springs, I think, and walking around for a few days, and he was talking to me about the whole story. And then he gave me documents and so on. He's very meticulous about keeping documents. And so he gave me documents that I could read. But he said, when you talk about my dad, treat him like he did your dad.
Nice.
Yeah. And, you know, that was touching to me. And I think it, you know, I mean, people would say, well, this was a guy, he was sort of grew up a fundamentalist. His father was rather rigid and so on. And that's why he wrote the book. Well, he doesn't see the story that way. His father, he believes, and his father worried about that. I mean, when the book came out, he said, is it because I raised you wrong, Ronnie? Mm. You know, was I too harsh or too rigidly fundamentalist? And Ron said, no, you were a lot more open than many of the parents of my friends, you know, and I appreciate you for that. So Ron came upon his own voice with that book on his own, I think, a lot more than, you know, you can't blame it on your background. If we could blame it on a background, you would blame George Knight for his background. You would blame anybody of that generation. I mean, you know, Knight had no more rigid a background than Numbers did, but they went different ways. So you still are left to answer why they go different ways, but you can't blame it on the Bible teachers and so you know, at least in my experience.
Talk to us a little bit about the, you know, Millerite Conference, I think it was 1983, 1984, that you were a part of, and of course, Vern Carner and Ron, and talk about, you know, I'm kind of curious about some of the backstory behind that, that leads up to, of course, the book Disappointed that you end up being a part of.
Well, I think there's a pattern to these mm-hmm. conferences, the Rise of Adventist, La Melinda, and the Disappointed, which were held in Killington, Vermont, and we toured Millerite sites when we were there, and the conference on Ellen Harmon White that came later in Portland, Maine. We were in Portland and ended up at a restaurant that had been Ellen Harmon's Chestnut Street Church. You know, we're sitting here, you know. But Killington, all the pattern to them is that non-SDAs were invited to mm-hmm. these conferences, and they ended up interacting with the SDAs. And they were, when you read papers, of course, the SDAs were reading the papers too, but when you read papers, you were reading it before this wider audience. And I think it affected how you approach things. And just mixing it up with these people. And that is, I think that's important for the SDAs. And I think that we're seeing more of that now. SDAs are not just insulated, right? I mean, now we're starting to, like you, Michael, with your Oxford project, you're dealing with people outside, and the people outside are interested. You know, I mean, the SDAs have been sort of kept to themselves, and they don't know. John Butler told me on the church history, I say, well, you know, I don't know enough about SDAs, and it really helped me reading your essay. You know, I got to know them more, and you know, so that's a good thing. It affects the work. It affects the work SDAs do. I think the Ellen Harmon Conference, there was sort of a women's union there too. There were some of them were non-SDAs and some of them were SDAs, but they had their own guild. So there were a bunch of these white males, and there were SDAs and non-SDAs, and then there were these women, and they had an impact on what they were upset with with the gender issue and how Ellen White, any condescension toward Ellen White was a real problem for them. And when I think, I know I'm maybe getting ahead of myself, but the Ellen Harmon White conference, the most critical people of Ellen White were the insiders. The outsiders were the more sympathetic to her and more empathic to her, and said, boy, you're sitting on a story here. And why are you so tough on her? Tell us the good stuff and why people were attracted to her and why the church did so well and all of that. We want to hear that story. And so it was an interesting, you learn some things from the outsider that you didn't expect. And you sort of self-examined in ways you didn't expect.
Yeah, I've had a similar experience even just working with some Pentecostal colleagues. I expected, you know, a little more derision when Ellen White comes up, but they've frankly always been kind of like, oh yeah, we've heard about her. She was, we have prophets too. Those are great. And I was like, oh, I can talk about this with a little less worry then. Okay.
Yeah. It's funny because I'm, you know, I don't know if you guys have read Steve Daly's book, Ellen White and the psychobiography of
it. I've seen it. I haven't picked it up yet.
Yeah. And I'm reviewing it for Spectrum. So I've got it on my mind at the moment. But Steve Daly, who no longer considers himself a Seventh-day Adventist, but he kind of went out through the Vineyard movement and is very open to Pentecostalism. And he's had a little church in which there are two women prophets in the church, right? Two women. I know both of them and have met them. One I went to college with. But And yet, while he's very favorable to sort of Pentecostal phenomena, he's very hard on Ellen White, right? So it's this contradiction that's interesting to me, and I'm not sure what's all at play there. I hear what you're saying about one of the prophets was a wife of a colleague of mine when I taught high school, and they were looking for a church. She's from a four square gospel background, very conservative, and very conservative. He listened to Rush Limbaugh every day, you know. I mean, he would, but I liked him very much. But he said, "Where can we go to church?" And I said, "Well, I know this guy Steve Daly's got a church, and he's got a prophet already in the church. So you could take your wife over there; she'd be a second prophet." She traveled with her brother, who was an evangelist, and she offered what she called the word of wisdom after the service, and was very, very much a sort of there was that element to it where she was seeing into their lives, right? But I met her and talked to her, and she was a most gracious, most refined person. And she knew I was writing about Ellen White. In fact, I was writing the chapter that ended up in Ellen Harmon White book. And she said, "You know, you have too few prophets in that church. You need more of them, because everything comes through the filter of this one person, and any problems she might have or hangups or the religion is defined by her." And we were at a Christmas party once, and her husband told me, he said, "Well, my wife's got a word of wisdom for you. She's got a message." And I said, "Oh my God, you know." So on our way to the car afterwards, after the party, she was chatting with me, and she said, "Well, I think you're doing the wrong thing here." I was teaching actually at an alternative high school then with kids that had dropped out of school, and they were on drugs, and their parents were crazy and incarcerated and all of that. But she said, "You know, you're doing the wrong thing. This is not fulfilling your potential. You need to be a Pentecostal minister. This is my word that I have for you." So I chuckled because I thought of it as a compliment, you know, coming from her. Mm. But
did you speak in tongues? That's the real thing we want to know.
Yeah, he did. Her husband did. Yeah.
Okay.
He'd sit in the lunchroom. I said, What is this business with tongues, Tom? I mean, I don't get it. What, you want me to do it?" I said, "Well, go ahead." And he just started blathering. I said, this sounded to me like Tourette syndrome or something. But the thing I went away from that experience with, I was quite moved by it. She was very affirming to me and complimentary to, there was no edge to it of criticism, you know. Mm. Or your life is screwed up and you need to do this. It was, and I know for a lot of Seventh-day Adventists, especially of my age, Ellen White, there's like baggage with Ellen White. I mean, they find her to be a difficult person to deal with. And I think she was a difficult person to deal with in many ways. And I think this was Elaine's, this prophet's point. You need different personalities bringing the message to you, not just the same person. And so she was sort of a living example of the point she was making.
Democratization of prophecy, huh?
Yeah, yeah. I think from many Seventh-day Adventists, they don't think we have too few prophets. They think we have too many. I mean, one was more than enough. But I see the point that maybe if you have more of them, more in a church, and people are offering their word to you, and there's other people who can sort of cross-examine it. Well, maybe that isn't the right thing, but maybe this is better. I mean, a little more in the Corinthians model, rather than the Old Testament sort of shake your bones model of prophecy.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting. I've had some interesting talks with my own Pentecostal friends around those lines, and they used to tell me, like, you know, the way you read Ellen White, you know, is similar in some ways, but at the same time, we kind of feel like you've maintained your fundamentalism here in regards to prophecy. And they said we've had so many of them for so long that, you know, it gives us an opportunity to hear God's voice all over. And I was like, that's an interesting open door, because we would look at that with an air of suspicion, and they're looking at our single as their own air suspicion. So, yeah.
But there's a good example of learning from an outsider, right? I mean,
right.
Begin thinking about things differently, and they can really contribute.
I want to hear a little bit more and back up just, you know, from the Millerite Conference. You kind of took a break for a while from Adventist history, I guess, and you know, I know you've mentioned that kind of the Portland conference in 2009 kind of re-whetted your appetite. Talk to us about your personal journey. I mean, you've seen some of the trauma of the journey along the way, as we've talked about with the historian as heretic. I mean, you were a witness firsthand to some of the traumatic aspects of that. Was that part of why you took a break? I'm kind of probing a little bit, but would like, you know, a little self-reflection on your own journey as to, you know, where you're at, that process.
Yeah, I guess there's probably a personal level to it and a professional level, but I left La Sierra in 85. I guess it was formally 80s. We came to a parting of the ways, and it had to do with intellectual differences, but it also had to do with lifestyle. And they insisted that it was amicable. In other words, they didn't want it to be construed as any sort of blaming going on, but there was blame in it. And they paid me a bunch of money to leave. I did think that my life really changed. I mean, I was treated well at La Sierra, but my life changed when I wrote an essay in Spectrum on the world of E.G. White and the end of the world, in which I put her eschatology in a 19th century context. And that was kind of my bombshell. You know, I don't know that it was a nuclear bomb. Maybe it was just TNT, you know, but that was the one that, and after that, the invitations to speak and the invitations to write and everything changed. And La Sierra became nervous about me. And then I got an NEH grant to write a biography of Ellen White. And it arrived in 84. And that, I think, was a real concern, because they said, oh, no, we've got another Ron Numbers on our hands here, another book on Ellen White, and he's got money to do it. I mean, you know, I can leave school for a sabbatical and do this. And about that time, these personal issues came up. So it was, you know, it was a convenient time to move me out of the school. And I left the church, certainly personally and professionally. I mean, I didn't want to continue as an American religion historian from the sidelines. I either was going to be in it or not. And I looked around for jobs, but I wanted to remain in Southern California because my wife had a good job and she was just getting started in her career. And I said, not fair to take her. I was offered things and, you know, I could have gone puddle hopping up in Montana or in central Michigan, but I just didn't think it was fair to her and uprooting the kids. So I stayed in Southern California. And like I say, I probably should have stayed in more than I did, wrote written reviews or, you know, sort of done high school teaching and stayed in the career, but I didn't. And it wasn't until, I mean, I was gone for close to 30 years. I mean, all this writing you're talking about or the stuff I did was mostly in a decade. I was 40 when I left La Sierra, and that was pretty much leaving that whole career. But then, I mean, there were, in the 90s, I did The Historian as Heretic, so I wasn't totally gone. But then when the Ellen Harmon White project came up, and Numbers was involved in that, and Julius Nam and Terry Amott and Gary Land and all these people, and they said, well, let's get Butler out of mothballs, and he could write the introduction or kind of the overview. And I didn't know that I could still do it. I mean, I hadn't been thinking about Ellen White for a quarter of a century. I didn't know if I had any ideas about her, you know, or I remembered when I was sort of obsessing on her as a historian, thinking about her and reading books that helped me understand her and so on. But now I hadn't been doing that. I just had not been doing anything. And then, so then they said, can you do this? And so I said, well, let me see. And so I started sort of messing with it. And things just came flooding back and I got very interested. And when I was in my 30s, late 30s, I was thinking about writing this biography of Ellen White. Well, then I forgot all about it. And then now I was in my 60s, and they said, okay, maybe I need to be writing this again. And I don't even know, I can't even tell you the difference between what I was like in my 30s thinking about her and what I'm like now thinking about her. I think there is a difference. I think had I written the book then, it would have been a different book than the book I'm writing now. Mm. And maybe even though I've probably lost a few steps and I spent all this time away from scholarship, in some ways, maybe it'll be a better book now. I don't know. I'll tell you this. I was probably more critical of her in my 30s and more empathic toward her now. And I think gender and my empathy for her as a woman is much stronger than it would have been then. I'm kind of glad in a way that things went the way they did and that I didn't write that book and that I'm writing this book. Although I could be dead before it's done.
Well, let's be optimistic here. tell us though, are you thinking of publishing outside the church or part of the Adventist biography series? I mean, you've done a lot of work at the beginning of this interview. We're talking about that's part of been your story is trying to give that larger context. What can we expect from a Jonathan Butler 2.0 biography of Ellen White?
Yeah, I mean, I think that my plan is always to write it outside the church. And most of the stuff I have written has been intentionally for the non-SDA, even though I understand that SDAs can track you down and read it and maybe enjoy it and appreciate it. But I've written inside the church a lot, but not as much history inside the church. I wrote a lot of devotional articles or stories or things like that. But when I'm writing history, to me, that's an art form that is different. It's like classical music for me when I'm writing history. And that's for the sort of cultivated audience. when I'm playing gospel music at the piano, that's for the SDAs, you know. So, you know, when I'm writing for, when I wrote for Insight or something like that, that was for the SDAs. When I'm, that's the gospel music. When I'm writing for Outside, it's the classical stuff. And, but I want to write in a way that ordinary people can enjoy it. I don't like this sort of monographic, you know, right, academies writing. I think it ought to be writing that anybody can read, and good writing can be cross the boundary, you know, so between academic and non-academic. So yeah, I would expect it to, I think it will have, gender is very much a preoccupation of it. Ellen White is a woman, and in a sense, a triumphant figure, a woman who is, yeah, has her flaws and is mired in many of the prejudices and problems of the 19th century, but ultimately is a triumphant, successful person who provides a model for people, not a foil to be sort of criticized.
That's an interesting way of looking at it. I really liked what you said before about how the book you might have written on her earlier would be different. Where would you like to see Adventist historians kind of move in the future with kind of this in mind? You know, what's the best places for us to start setting new targets? Are we just revisionist? Are we looking at an audience outside of the church primarily? What topics or trends even do you think would be significant for future historians to tackle?
I think of C.S. Lewis saying, you know, that we need, we don't need more Christian books. We need more Christians writing about other subjects, you know, that kind of thing. What was it? Was it George Target that said, we don't need an Adventist football team. We need Adventists playing for other teams, you know? So I would like to see probably the future of historiography. And I think we're at the future. I mean, it's starting to happen where SDAs are not talking to each other. They're talking to the outside. And we went through this period, like I talk about in the essay, of this revisionism where we were sort of iconoclasts and taking on the tradition and saying there's all these problems with the tradition and all these problems with our understanding of Ellen White. Now we're into this apologetic period, which the Adventist Pioneer Series, I think, is a great example of, where we're saying constructive thing. We're remembering the criticism, the iconoclasm, but we're integrating it into a more constructive way of understanding history, which I think lay SDAs can appreciate. And I would think global SDAs, you know, could appreciate. But I do think there's another phase now that's out there, and it's starting to happen, where SDAs and non-SDAs are writing about the church, and writing about Ellen White, and can say some surprising things, some fresh things. So, you know, when you get a non-SDA coming in and dipping his or her foot in the water, I mean, it's an interesting, you learn stuff that way. And that's what I would like to see more of. And of course, they'll be drawing on, as they come in from the outside, they'll be drawing on what's gone on in the community for the last 40, 50 years.
Well, this is feeling like a good stopping point.
Well, thank you, both of you. And I look forward to the whole series. I think it'll be fun to hear. And it's great you guys are doing this.
And Jesus himself said that he did not come to do away with the law.
Us out of this world if he does not want us to be contaminated by it.
The Adventist Pilgrimage Podcast is part of the Adventist History Podcast Network. You can find other podcasts as well as additional content from this podcast by following us on YouTube and Facebook. If you'd like to support this show or others on the Adventist History Podcast Network, please visit patreon.com/Adventist History Podcast. Enjoy the show.